welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, December 18, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, Case Study in Government Overreach, the LabMD case. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, Reed D. Rubenstein, who is of counsel at Cause of Action and a partner at Dinsmore & Scholl, LLP. He's going to give us some introductory remarks about this case, and then we are going to turn it over to audience questions. So, without further ado, Ms. Rubenstein, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you, everyone, for calling in to talk about the LabMD case. What I'm going to do is briefly go through some of the factual background, identify some of the more unusual developments, and then we'll open it up for questions. For those of you who practice in the administrative space or are representing clients who have issues or concerns with respect to data security, you're probably well aware of the case. If you're not, I would urge you to go to the FTC website and read at least the administrative law judge's initial decision and some of the other pleadings over the course of this matter. It's stranger than fiction. If this were a movie script, it would be rejected because no one could believe that what happened in this case actually occurred. But as improbable as what I'm going to describe is going to sound, it all did happen. And it is a fascinating case study in the consequences, the very real-world consequences of government overreach. LabMD was a cancer diagnosis lab, essentially a pathology shop. And shortly in the early aughts, it developed a innovative approach to handling samples and diagnostic activity. Essentially computerized everything and allowed doctors to communicate with the lab directly. As a result, the time and cost of diagnosis went down and accuracy went way up. But this was kind of at the beginning of the full deployment of the internet and systems had to be developed and software, specific kinds of software had to be developed. And LabMD worked all of this out and became a very successful business, benefited doctors, benefited patients. And it was what the federal government wanted the medical industry to do, which is to begin to take advantage of the efficiencies associated with computers and the internet. Fast forward to 2005, 2006, there was a problem with, or perceived problem at that point in time, with file sharing over the internet and peer-to-peer software. The music and entertainment industries in particular were quite upset about this. The House Oversight Committee, led at that point by Henry Waxman, a Democrat from California, began holding hearings about the dangers posed due to file sharing. And the Federal Trade Commission, which was partly by self-anointment and partly by default viewed as the federal government's regulator of data security, came in and testified. In fact, did a study of peer-to-peer software and conceded it was a neutral threat. Worked quite closely with companies like LimeWire and others and put reports out there and basically said, look, this peer-to-peer stuff could be a problem. But we don't see it as being that much different than any other use of the internet. At the same time, this is again circa 05, 06, 07, there was a company started up in Pittsburgh by the name of Tyversa, and Tyversa made money by providing quote, remediation, close quote, services with respect to peer-to-peer file sharing, inadvertent peer-to-peer file sharing. Tyversa did some work for the federal government, and it appeared to testify about the risks associated with peer-to-peer file sharing, suggesting that even classified information was just widely available on the internet for anybody who had the ability to navigate peer-to-peer systems. The FTC and Tyversa testified together at a congressional hearing in 2007, and that led to a collaboration between the two. This benefited the FTC because it obtained information from Tyversa, and it benefited Tyversa because by being so intimately involved with the FTC, it could engage in public competition and use the FTC in a way to solicit clients. In late 2007, 2008, Tyversa began working with a researcher at Dartmouth College who had obtained a contract from the Department of Homeland Security to study medical information data security. Under HIPAA, medical providers are regulated by the Department of Health and Human Services and are required to take steps to maintain the security and privacy of patient information. Tyversa and Dartmouth collaborated on this study. Tyversa, which purported to have a unique web crawler, as if it were, that allowed it to search peer-to-peer networks much faster rate and to download information much more efficiently, went out and tried to find medical files to give to Dartmouth so that Dartmouth could use it in this study. In February of 2008, though, an individual by the name of Rick Wallace, who was, according to the testimony, sort of the director of special projects at Tyversa, who did special work for the CEO, a man named Boback, was searching the peer-to-peer networks looking for information that, according to his testimony, could be monetized by Tyversa, medical information. And as it happened, at LabMD, this little company in Atlanta, never employed more than 30 people, there was a billing manager who, contrary to company policy, had LimeWire, apparently, for sharing music files on a workstation. Mr. Wallace managed to use that connection to take files off of the billing manager's hard drive, one of which was an insurance aging file. It was approximately a year old. This was the only insurance aging file on the hard drive. It wasn't supposed to be there either, but Mr. Wallace got a hold of it and took it in violation of HIPAA because he was not authorized to have this information. Certainly, Tyversa did not have patient authorization. And LabMD argued in violation of Georgia's computer theft statute. In April 2008, in response to a request from Dartmouth asking Tyversa to provide more information to spice up, Dartmouth's words, spice up its report, Tyversa transmitted this file, this LabMD file, which is known as the 1718 file for the number of individuals listed, 1,718. Again, in violation of the law, because neither Dartmouth nor Tyversa were authorized to either share or obtain this HIPAA-regulated information. And it became a centerpiece in the Dartmouth report, again funded by the Department of Homeland Security, about the problems associated with medical data security. Again, there was testimony before Congress, 1718 file was listed, and the FTC became very interested in what was going on. After a series, apparently, of communications, and we know this from a separate House oversight investigation of Tyversa and of the FTC and of their relationship, an agreement was made whereby Tyversa would transfer information it had obtained to the FTC and to shield Tyversa The parties agreed that Tyversa would create a front company called the Privacy Institute. The Federal Trade Commission would issue a civil investigative demand to the Privacy Institute. Tyversa would give this information, which, according to the testimony, had been sort of agreed and outlined, you know, beforehand, to the Privacy Institute. The Privacy Institute would transfer that in turn to the Federal Trade Commission. According to emails there in a House report, Tyversa was quite pleased with this arrangement because it now had kind of advance notice of who the FTC was going after, and it could go and solicit them for business. It also appeared that, at least from the testimony in the case, that only those companies that refused to buy Tyversa's services were put on the list, although Tyversa disputes that, in fact, being the case. Take a step back. In 2008, in May of 2008, LabMD receives a phone call from Tyversa advising it that LabMD patient information is freely available on the Internet. LabMD asked for evidence of this, which Tyversa refuses to provide, although it did send, apparently, a copy of the file to LabMD. LabMD then does a search, discovers the LimeWire, removes it from its computer. This is, again, May of 2008, but declines to purchase services from Tyversa, which had been offered for approximately $40,000. LabMD then moves on. There has never been any evidence that LabMD's patient information was ever compromised or hacked, or that any such information was ever freely available on the Internet before or after this incident. January 2010, the FTC issues a press release talking about its great investigation of peer-to-peer networks and sends out a series of letters to the individuals and companies that are on the list it received from Tyversa in August of 2009 through the Privacy Institute. One of the companies on that list was LabMD, and the letter goes out to LabMD saying, you know, we're the FTC, and, you know, would you voluntarily show us your data security, because we have reason to believe that you've had, through LimeWire, that one of your files has been made available for sharing. LabMD agrees to cooperate with the Federal Trade Commission, which in retrospect was a mistake. Provides documents, a series of meetings, and the upshot of it is eventually the FTC issues a civil investigative demand to LabMD. The FTC demands that LabMD enter into a very onerous consent order, and essentially refuses to tell LabMD how it got a hold of the file or to address LabMD's concerns that this was the result of a theft by Tyversa. The FTC wouldn't acknowledge this at all. At that time, obviously, the FTC was kind of working very, very closely with Tyversa, and they were aligned substantively on this and apparently other matters as well, if the House Oversight Committee report is to be believed, and if the testimony of the Tyversa employee Rick Wallace is to be believed. Eventually, the relationship between LabMD and FTC staff becomes rather acrimonious. There are well-founded allegations of retaliation in that once LabMD refused to sign a consent order and began criticizing the FTC that a decision was made to bring an administrative complaint against LabMD. And in August of 2013, the case was filed. Now, there was never an allegation of actual consumer injury. In other words, the FTC had no victims, at least presented none. No individuals who had their identity stolen, no individuals who had suffered medical identity theft, none of this, which struck us all very odd. Once we began litigating this case, The very first deposition that the FTC took was of Tyversa and Mr. Boback. And at that deposition, Mr. Boback offered and the FTC introduced an exhibit that listed five IP addresses where the 1718 file had been found. None of them, though, were the Atlanta IP address of LabMD. These were IP addresses of known identity thieves and other, and Mr. Boback testified to that. The CX-19, which was the way that the exhibit was labeled, is the only written evidence that the LabMD 1718 file was ever found, so to speak, anywhere other than a LabMD computer. In other words, this is the evidence that the file had, quote, spread. And this piece of evidence, according to the testimony, had been prepared by Mr. Wallace. The FTC did not produce this document, so it would seem that it filed the complaint without any evidence that this file ever spread, on the one hand. On the other hand, the evidence of spread became the centerpiece of its case. It was the basis for its expert opinions with respect to harm, and it was the talking point that the FTC lawyers kept coming back to until the testimony and the truth came out that this piece of evidence was fabricated. The case was aggressively defended and aggressively litigated. There were many depositions, and eventually all of this became too much for the company to bear, and it went under. We, as defense counsel, had noticed Mr. Wallace's deposition. Wallace, as I said, had been identified as the individual who had prepared CX-19 and who could testify to evidence of spread and demonstrate that this file had been found in the hands of identity thieves and others. But a very strange thing happened. He didn't appear for his deposition. The attorneys for Tyversa first said he was sick. When we asked for the usual doctor's letter to verify that, to put off the notice of deposition, the FTC, out of left field, chimed in and said no, there was no need for that because Tyversa was telling the truth. Subsequently, Tyversa said, well, he no longer works for the company, and therefore we can't produce him. It was very strange. Another kind of very strange piece of this was that the expert depositions, which we took of the FTC's, particularly their consumer harm experts, suggested that there ought to have been thousands of victims of identity theft. And they cited this information provided by Tyversa that the 1718 file was freely available on the internet and had spread. And yet there were none, which meant really only one of two things. Either the experts' theories were bunk, or the file had not spread, as FTC and Tyversa had claimed. So it really didn't add up. But then Rick Wallace, who no longer works for Tyversa, sort of drops out of the sky. And long story short, he shows up on the last day of the administrative case, takes the fifth. We obtain through the Department of Justice an immunity for him, which the administrative law judge orders. Highly unusual kind of a proceeding in an administrative case. And in May of this year, he testifies. And what he testifies is at least according to the trade press, a bombshell. He testifies that Tyversa's business model was to shake down companies, to fabricate evidence. He testifies to meetings with the FTC and that after these meetings, one of which included the lead complaint counsel in this case, he was directed to fabricate spread, which he did. That was CX-19. The evidence suggested that the FTC knew from the beginning that there had been no spread and yet didn't disclose this. The FTC knew from the beginning that Tyversa made money off of FTC enforcement action, yet never verified the information it obtained from Tyversa. In fact, LabMD had filed a motion to quash the original civil investigative demand to LabMD, and that was denied. But one of the dissenting commissioners said that it was obvious that Tyversa was an interested party and that the FTC should not rely on that information. The administrative law judge pointed that out in his decision, that the FTC failed to heed this good advice, much to its sorrow. Mr. Wallace, as I said, testified in May of 2015. The case was, post-trial briefing occurred in August and September, and then November 13th, the administrative law judge issued a decision dismissing the complaint. In his decision, he found that the evidence provided by Tyversa was unreliable. He found that the experts, contrary to the representations of complaint counsel, relied on Mr. Bobak's testimony. He cited the House oversight investigation that took place during the pendency of the administrative case to suggest that the FTC did not undertake the appropriate diligence in its investigation or use the appropriate care that it should have. And after doing a plain language statutory interpretation of Section 5, the unfairness provision of the FTC Act, he found that complaint counsel had failed to prove even the first element of its case, that there was some harm to consumers. In this case, he said there was only speculative potential harm. There was no evidence of harm. The expert case was deficient, and so he dismissed the matter. Immediately thereafter, complaint counsel filed an appeal, that appeal now is in process. So that is in a very, very truncated form the case that we're looking at. There was all sorts of collateral litigation in the 11th Circuit, a raft of constitutional and administrative claims raised in addition to the OGR investigation, a highly unique case, but one that very clearly demonstrates the dangers of agency that's unleashed and that recognizes no limits on what it can do when a company pushes back. So with that, I'll take questions.
Sure. Thanks so much for your remarks there. We're going to just jump right into questions. In a moment, you'll all hear a prompt that says the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. So we're going to get to these questions in the order in which we receive the requests. As we wait for some questions to queue up, I just want to remind everyone to be checking back at the Teleforum website to see what the future programming is. And we are going to move into the first audience question. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, this is Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federalist Society, and I was struck at the National Lawyers Conference. One of the practice groups had an event talking about federal prosecutors. The expression was running amok, which may or may not be the phrase we would choose. But the amount of abuse that seems to come out of federal government these days of individuals and of businesses. That was in the criminal context. I wanted to ask whether or not the speaker today really thought that there was much practical distinction between the kind of rough handling in a civil context that his client received and the kind of rough handling that criminal defendants sometimes receive at the hand of U.S. attorneys or at the hand of the Justice Department.
Yeah, thanks for that question. You know, it's interesting. A cause of action actually filed an amicus brief in a Ninth Circuit case about whether or not the Brady Rule applies in civil proceedings, a case called Moonlight. It's, you know, going to be argued, I guess, in the next 2 months or so. It's obviously a very significant problem. During the early stages of this case, November 2013, one of the sitting commissioners, a fellow named Joshua Wright, he has since left the commission, published research stating that in Section 5 cases, in 100% of the cases where the administrative law judge had found for the commission, or for complaint counsel, the commission upheld that opinion. And in 100% of the cases where the administrative law judge had found for the respondent, the commission had overruled him or her over a period of at least 2 decades, meaning that once the commission votes out a complaint, case is over because you can't win as a respondent. And that vibe, you know, is kind of, at least in this particular case, played out, you know, from the beginning. Essentially, the complaint counsel, the regulator, believes it can do whatever it wants. The way the law is structured, it's very hard, and the Supreme Court jurisprudence on this goes back really into the Second World War, shortly thereafter period. But it's very hard to fight the government on these, and as, again, this Commissioner Wright points out in a subsequent speech and article, the administrative process advantages that the agencies have essentially drive settlements. The costs of fighting back are so significant, you know, the reputational costs, the economic costs, and the notion that if you're going to stay in business, you've got to do business with the regulator, you know, what the pushing back does to that relationship. The costs are just so high, it's the old process as punishment, and that's very much, you know, what happened here. The FTC fully expected LabMD to roll over the way that all of the other companies that the FTC had pursued had, and enter a consent order. The FTC believed that it could create an administrative common law, you know, wrap your head around that concept, through consent orders. And unfortunately for them, there was finally a company that said no, and we're going to push back. But LabMD was very roughly handled, and you know, one of the suggestions is that the part of the reason for the rough handling is to send a message to anybody else who might dare to push back. Certainly a problem. It needs to be addressed. It may take ultimately federal legislation, but we need to really, I think, federal society and others, you know, care about freedom. We really need to be focused on this kind of abuse as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, again, our lines are wide open. If you'd like to ask a question, go ahead and press the star and then the pound key on your telephone. Seeing none, I have a couple. Oh, actually, let's go ahead and get to the next question from the audience. Go ahead, caller.
This is Eddie Grime at Graves Garrett Law Firm in Kansas City, Missouri. And we've been involved with some recently with some overreach, but at the state level, a campaign finance agency. My question is this. Listening to your description of the litigation, have you considered whether there's any sort of professional misconduct occurring here? And as soon as I ask that question, that's a hard thing to answer with a bunch of other lawyers. I wonder if you've thought about various ways of pushing back outside of the proceeding itself?
Well, one of the things that we tried to do from the beginning, at least tactically, was to see if we could get into a more level playing field based on Commissioner Wright's research, which, you know, validates, I think, the experience of most practitioners. The notion of a truly kind of fair process and level playing field, the idea you're going to get that in an administrative proceeding is sometimes very difficult to accept because of the process, built-in process and legal advantages that agencies have. So a number of collateral issues were raised. The 11th Circuit, in an appeal that at the time seemed to be a bit of an outrider, but since then the D.C. Circuit has ruled similarly, held that pretty much everything, all constitutional claims and everything else, have to be channeled through the administrative case before you can get the administrative process, I should say, before you can get to an Article III court, even if you're told, as we were told in this case by the administrative law judge, that your claims, in our case, a First Amendment retaliation claim, are not part of the administrative proceeding and therefore can't do discovery, can't raise them. You know, which makes it challenging. With respect to the, you know, misconduct issue, once the evidence became, you know, once we got evidence as to what was going on, and the oversight committee began publishing its, you know, sending letters with documentation and kind of demonstrating what really went on here, we moved to dismiss the case on the theory that all of the evidence was derivative of unlawful conduct, including by the agency, and that the cases, the authorities make it very clear that government lawyers have a heightened duty both to the tribunal and to the targets of government power. And we argued that the case needed to be dismissed on those grounds. We argued that in the post-trial briefing, and as I said, we filed a motion. The administrative law judge never reached the issue. He simply applied Section 5 and said that the proofs had failed. But certainly the record here is very suggestive of if not malfeasance, then certainly nonfeasance, and we have argued and that in our briefs below that and will argue, I assume, again on appeal, that complaint counsel failed to discharge its professional duties appropriately in this case.
Okay, our lines are wide open again. If anyone has a question, enter the star and then the pound key on your telephone. Seeing no questions queued up, I think I'll follow up with a question here. So if ultimately found to have been acting improperly, even if not necessarily in bad faith, do you think the agency here will suffer any meaningful negative consequences?
Well, there are a couple of, I mean, there's already been some negative consequences to the agency. The congressional investigation and the facts that have come out through that and the testimony from Mr. Wallace, and it's notable that although complaint counsel had the opportunity both to depose him and to cross-examine him, it did neither. It does not paint a pretty picture. And complaint counsel admitted in pleadings in this case that it did not verify the information it had obtained from Tyversa. And the kind of things that we were pointing out, you know, doing your homework, doing some diligence, asking kind of what's your informant's interest, things of that nature, are basic. And attorneys at other agencies have told me that they use this case as a primer on what not to do and as an example of the kind of conduct that can derail or end an attorney's career. In terms of, you know, other sanctions, yeah, obviously it's speculation, but it's very hard to look at the record and walk away feeling like the government cared much about the integrity of the administrative process. Instead, you can perhaps come to the conclusion that the case was premised on the idea that, and the government's actions were premised on the idea that there would be a consent order and that it would never go to trial. And then they ended up in a trial situation with aggressive defense counsel that was there to really explore and push, and it didn't end well.
So you mentioned sort of the threat of, you know, or the prospect of an attorney having his or her career derailed or ended over an incident like this. But do you think there are any other meaningful disincentives for individuals employed at agencies to sort of discourage them from this kind of behavior so that it won't happen again going forward?
Well, there's a... First of all, there are always going to be situations where no matter how well you design the system, there are going to be abuses. That's just human nature. So, you know, you're not going to get to a zero error rate. Your idea is to make it as small as possible. And one of the things that you do is develop a culture among the prosecutors of prudence and this notion that prosecutors owe a duty to the truth. And again, the jurisprudence is very clear about this. The Supreme Court has said as much. Government lawyers have a heightened duty. What I've seen over the course, you know, certainly over the course, I want to say, of the last 8 years, is an erosion in that culture, and instead agencies believe that they are empowered, and agency lawyers believe that they are empowered, and because there are really no meaningful external checks on their conduct, because, for example, you have to wait to go through the entire administrative process before you can get an Article III court to take a look at the situation. Because typically Congress won't investigate the way it did in this case, I think it's because the facts were so egregious, there really is no way to stop overreach until you've been ground up in the process and you go to a federal court, which itself takes years. And for most companies, the economics just don't work. And until some action is taken, and whether that's legislative or judicial decisions that will, for example, require some sort of probable cause for an agency to investigate. LabMD spent hundreds and hundreds of hours of management employee time and hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees in dealing with the agency's demands in a case where there were no victims. All right, this is really important. There were no victims here, ever. And yet the agency has the right to investigate for any reason or simply to assure itself, the law is not being broken or violated. And most people don't know this, but literally an administrative agency has the authority to come in, demand all the records, see all your computer files without any evidence that there's any wrongdoing at all. That's what the Supreme Court has said. And that needs to be changed, obviously, by just simply applying some sort of check and requiring an agency to go to a court before it can begin wading through a company's records, you know, that would, I think, go a long way to limiting, you know, in the first instance, the overreach. Second problem, particularly in this case, was that the regulators are looking to expand their authority, and they don't do it through Congress, and they don't do it through the Article III courts. They tried this actually in the Wyndham case, and the Third Circuit advised the FTC that it actually had to apply Section 5 as it was written. So the FTC's position was that Section 5 prohibits unreasonable data security, unreasonable existing in a vacuum, because there are no agency standards, there are no regulations, there are no trade guidelines, nothing. Rather, according to the FTC, it has the authority years after the fact to have a paid expert look at a case, determine that your data security was, for whatever reason, unreasonable, not measured against your industry standards, mind you, but by the expert's own say-so, and then declare you violated Section 5. That kind of thing has to stop, because it gives agencies tremendous power, and since most cases companies are going to sign a consent order and move on, essentially allows them to create their own law and do whatever they want and evade judicial review. It's got to stop.
Well, we have Reed Rubenstein here for almost 20 more minutes, so if any other listeners have a question, go ahead and dial star and then the pound key on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. So, Reed, do you see this case as sort of a one-off, or is this problem being repeated at other agencies throughout the government? Are there any other stories of this kind of conduct that you can share?
You know, really, it depends on the agency. The conduct in this case was unique in many respects, primarily because of the relationship between the agency and an economically interested third party, the absence of any diligence or minimal diligence at best by the agency lawyers prior to commencing enforcement action. Obviously, the whistleblower, the constitutional issues raised, of which there were a number. In some respects, this is a one-off. That said, though, the fundamental problem and the reason for the overreach, kind of the institutional dynamics that drive overreach, are common across agencies. And in some agencies, you have enforcement staff and attorneys who are less aggressive and are more concerned about truth seeking than putting notches onto their belt, and others less so. So it really depends. And again, without these institutional controls, the field is ripe for abuse. Now, one of the things I should point out is kind of the central thesis that Josh Wright has offered, which is that simply because the game is so very much structured in favor of the regulators, you end up with a situation where folks make a rational cost-benefit analysis and just give up their rights in exchange for being allowed to get on with their lives. Charles Murray, in his recent book, made the same point. It's why he's advocating, I guess, for the creation of this Madison Fund, so that companies, particularly small ones, will be able to fund and stand up challenges to abusive administrative action. Without something like that, though, there is no public defender for companies that get hauled before an administrative agency. And it's very expensive to try and defend these cases, particularly in the FTC, but before any administrative agency. It's an expensive process to go through. And then, in at least at the FTC, you're statistically certain to lose. And then you've got to go appeal. So that's years of your time, countless hundreds of thousands of dollars of money. And if you can buy peace and appease the regulator, even if the cost of giving up some rights, in many cases, that's, frankly, just the most rational thing to do. And it's incumbent on us to try and alter that calculus of rationality in a variety of ways.
You mentioned a number of constitutional issues raised by this case. In your estimation, what are two or three of the most significant ones?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there are quite a number. I would identify three, though, as being of particular interest. Four. First one is what constitutes fair notice, and can the Federal Trade Commission make up data security standards as it goes? You know, what can agencies do to create, you know, what they call common law? And how can they apply that, and what notice must they give regulated companies? It's a fascinating issue. The Third Circuit talked about the duty of agencies to provide ascertainable certainty. That's something that the FTC opposes. So we'll see how that plays out. So that's one. The second is an appointments clause. Whether or not the FTC lawfully appointed the administrative law judge in this case, it's an issue we raised. Under the FTC's rules, it was something that the administrative law judge had the authority to decide at the time we raised it, but the FTC reached down, citing without authority listed its plenary control over the proceeding. It said that the appointments clause claims are meritless, but, oh, by the way, here's an order of appointment. So we'll see what, you know, how that shakes out. A third, in my view, very interesting constitutional issue arises out of the use of the tainted evidence in this case, and this idea of fruit of the poisonous tree, which typically, you know, there's case law that suggests that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply in administrative cases. The argument, of course, is that this isn't a Fourth Amendment question. Rather, it's just a basic due process question. Should they be able to rely on evidence obtained illegally or as a result of illegal or unethical conduct by the government or its officials? And, you know, we'll see how that plays out. And then finally, there's kind of the bedrock issue, constitutional issue, which is if you have an administrative case or administrative process, rather, in which your case, you know, is certain to lose, does that rise to the kind of due process that's guaranteed according to Supreme Court precedent, you know, Withrow versus Larkin? I mean, you're not entitled in an administrative case for a variety of reasons to the same process as a criminal case. That's a separate discussion. But you are entitled to some, and the question is whether a process that results in a 100% win rate for the agency is constitutional. Now, you know, our position is that, you know, not even in the Soviet Union did they get 100% of win rate. You know, they might in Iran. I guess that's a, you know, comparable. But this can't be right. This can't be constitutional. And it'll be interesting to see what, you know, in an Article III court, what how that gets handled and what the result is.
We have time for one, maybe two more questions, so we're going to move to a call-in question. Go ahead, caller.
David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California. Interesting discussion. My question
Thank you.
Has to do with at its really its source, the different nature between the adversarial parties in these proceedings, and that the government is often a very much a repeat player and is playing for the long game. And what I've noticed in my practice is that, you know, certain government agencies, they take the easy cases, and, you know, if they actually have a sense that they might actually lose a case in, you know, one of their administrative enforcement actions, and it might create some adverse precedent for them, then surprisingly very close to, you know, the judicial decision, there'll be some kind of backing down and accommodation, and the case will be quietly settled. So that the net result is that we don't get any kind of forward jurisprudence action, because the difficult cases that run against the government, they're willing to settle. And it all has to do with the fact that they are playing a numbers game. So do you have any comments on how that symptom might be addressed?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I know criminal prosecutors do something similar. you know, in that they tend to take to trial the, you know, the easier cases and settle out the ones that are more problematic. I guess it really, from my standpoint, the ultimate solution to this problem, really, there are two things that have to occur. One, businesses that are unfairly, improperly caught up in the regulatory mess have to be willing to push back. If companies are not going to stand up for themselves, you know, it's very hard to do anything to move the bar, protect them or others. And the second aspect is that work needs to be done. And again, whether this is a cultural thing or it's a reason, or we need, you know, better legislative checks and balances on agency actions, a culture of prudence and restraint needs to be restored. For the last, like I said, 8-9 years, the agencies have been acting as if they are unleashed, and in fact, they have been. And you're getting abuses and outcomes accordingly. That's got to stop. That's got to stop. Because what you're going to see is what you're getting now. They're going to continue to expand and push, particularly the FTC is going to continue to expand and push the boundaries of its authority, because if it can take the position that it need not have regulations, it need not give you notice before the fact of what is permitted or prohibited, you can only imagine then what tremendous discretion and authority the enforcement personnel have.
Again, if anyone else has a question, just dial star and then the pound key on your telephone. Right now, our lines are open. I think we probably have time for one more question. If you'd like to be that last question, again, just hit star and then the pound key on your telephone. Seeing none, I'm wondering if you could just talk really briefly about some practical implications for other businesses or individuals that might be facing administrative enforcement action.
Sure. The old rule that generally it's in your interest to buy peace. For small businesses, mid-sized businesses, I'm not sure that rule necessarily obtains. The way the regulatory system is set up now, it's paradoxically, if you are a large company and you are able to negotiate and you're smart and strategic about how you negotiate your consent order, you can use that actually to help preserve your marketplace position and to hamper competition. For example, in the LabMD case, LabMD is a small business. It was regulated under HIPAA. One of the principles of HIPAA regulation is called scalability. In other words, you got to look at the size and the nature of the business before you start making regulatory demands. The testimony of the expert the FTC offered in this case, though, was quite the opposite. It was that there is one standard, and irrespective of the size of the business, that companies have to meet. And that means that whether you are, you know, Nova Health Systems, or which employs thousands of people, or, you know, LabMD, which at its height employed 30, you are under the same obligation to troll the FTC's websites to, according to the testimony of Daniel Kaufman that we took. Regulated parties are supposed to read congressional testimony and know what's in footnotes. Take a look at things like Spanish language flyers to know what the agency's thinking is and to know what is permitted or prohibited. And again, it doesn't matter whether you're a little company or a big company, you have to do these things. On its face, that's just ridiculous. But that was their position, is their position. The only way that's going to stop, short of congressional legislation, is if enough companies are willing to call them on it and fight them, which brings us back sort of to Charles Murray's point about the need for companies to stand up and to make the costs of agency action significant enough that it imposes some prudence and you know, helps clarify judgment and ensure that taxpayer funds are spent on enforcing in cases where, for example, you have companies, you know, in the Section 5 data security context that are willfully ignoring their obligations and that that results in actual harm to consumers. Not a case like LabMD where you had a crony company that was engaging in public competition, according to the testimony, that used a highly expert individual to take a file and then attempt to monetize it. I mean, there needs to be some discernment and some judgment. And if the agencies aren't going to exercise it, it needs to be imposed from the outside.
Reed, do you have time to take one more
sure.
question from a caller? Great.
Sure.
Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Lenore Ostrowski. I'm sorry I only joined the call late. Have you spoken to why the Federal Trade Commission, faced with what was obviously, if anyone had looked at it, a train wreck from their point of view, why they have persisted, why they have allowed their attorneys to persist in this?
Yeah, hi, Lenore. Thanks for listening. I don't know the answer to that question. We can speculate. But it doesn't make sense. And in our briefing, we in fact addressed that particular fact. One of the really, really kind of puzzling things to me, just as a practical matter, is that the whistleblower came forward, produced this testimony which was devastating both to the nature and the quality of the evidence and to the FTC's complaint counsel's conduct. Just devastating. But they didn't cross-examine him, which meant that the evidence went in uncontroverted. The ALJ found him to be credible, which, I mean, in looking at him and listening to him, this was not a person, at least on the stand, who appeared to be making things up. And yet, they continue on with the case. The FTC has, interestingly, has never said, we were duped by Tyversa. Never. Which you would think would be the first thing that they would do.
Well,
I don't know what you make of that.
It isn't just, you know, if I were them, I wouldn't want to admit that I had been so foolish. But generally, when things are going this badly, as you said a little while ago, there would be an attempt to settle, which, of course, LabMD would never have agreed to, but in other words, drop the case. They could call it settling, but in fact, they would be dropping the case with no resolution, and it would end up making them look far less bad than they're going to look.
Well, I think they believe that, again, they're going for a commission where they don't lose, ever, according to Joshua Wright. So I suppose there is that going for them. They've committed to this case millions of our dollars. So, you know, it's like trying to turn a battleship. I think particularly in light of the ALJ's opinion, which adopts the reasoning with respect to Section 5 that the Third Circuit used, that cabins the commission's authority to go, you know, on fishing expeditions, among other things. And I don't think they like that. I think they want broad, undifferentiated authority. So perhaps all of those factors are weighing in, and you know, we have to sort of wait and see what the commission ultimately does with the case. But I really, it's kind of hard to understand, as you said, why they wouldn't call this train wreck off when they had multiple opportunities to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, We're right up on the 3 o'clock hour here, so on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Reed Rubenstein for joining us today. Also, thank you to everyone who listened in on the call and asked questions. We really appreciate it. Keep checking our website at fedtalk.org to see when the next teleforums are going to be coming up. And again, thank you to Mr. Rubenstein. And with that, we are adjourned. So long for just a while.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.